Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy from Paradigm Sports. Thanks for joining us for our second summit this one winter through our digital platform for Love of the Game. Our list of guest speakers amazes me. Each one of them has shared some amazing nuggets, and hopefully you're getting some great insight. Our next guest is Dave Newsom. He's currently the executive director of Semiamo Minor Hockey in South Surrey, British Columbia. Prior roles include sledge hockey technical delegate for the International Paralympic Committee, sport coordinator for the 2010 Olympic and Paralympics in Vancouver, BC. And prior to that, he had coached the UBC female or women's hockey team for about 10 years from 1998 to 2008. Really appreciate making time for this, Dave. Thanks for joining us and looking forward to our chat.
My pleasure, Glenn. Glad I could help out.
Perfect. So first question I ask everybody, doesn't matter where they are in the space, where did you grow up and what sports did you play as a kid?
Sure. Yeah. I grew up on the main streets of Burnaby, British Columbia. Active in a number of different sports. Dabbled, I guess, in a little bit of everything as a kid growing up. Played minor baseball. Did track and field and those sort of things through school programs. But hockey became my main love. Relatively quickly at a young age, and had a lot of great experience through that, and played through to some junior hockey and that type of thing.
What was your greatest memory when you were growing up in your youth sports?
From an organized sport perspective, there's a couple, but me, I think my greatest memories came from the unorganized part of things. I could probably make a safe argument that there's nobody on the planet that has put in more hours of street hockey or road hockey than I did.
I don't know. I think I got you on that one.
Well, if you went to school on a regular basis, you couldn't have beat me, because as soon as school ended, I was playing the whole bit. The only way you could do it is if you didn't go to school. And some of my best memories are just the good times out doing that stuff. From a structured team perspective, it's funny, I don't remember a lot of the wins, losses, and tournaments and those sort of things. My best memories are dressing room time with guys and friends and stuff like that. We used to have a drop-in hockey session that was relatively, again, unstructured, that we'd come out to on early mornings. And we just play multi-age, go out there and just have some fun. Probably my most vivid memories come from those experiences.
Yeah, the infamous shinny hockey and it's evolved to, or if you had opportunity to play pond hockey, which many people in BC didn't have because we don't have that. But when growing back east, I was pond and I got to skate and play on the Rideau Canal in Ottawa, and also played a lot of outdoor hockey. So that to me, and the best part of it was there was no coaches or parents or the refs didn't tell us what to do because they weren't there, and we just formed our own rules, like AKA Bobby Orr, which is, that's what he feels strongly has helped him become the player he became. So when did you actually specialize? When did you decide hockey was the sport you were going to?
Probably would have been early teen years. So, to 12, 13 or so. Kind of the baseball fell away a little bit. And it's not like I went, even back in those days, there wasn't as much spring, summer hockey, that type of thing. I remember one year we played spring hockey, and it was recreational spring hockey, to be honest with you, at that time. So we went and did that. I wouldn't necessarily call it specializing, but it was more kind of dropping off the other sports. And I guess it was more tailoring the training piece and using the time and resources that we put into the other sports to go to hockey schools and do, you know, maybe a little bit of power skating and off ice training and those type of pieces. I wouldn't, compared to today's standards, I don't know if I'd call that specialization.
Yeah, it was kind of the norm, when, especially if you're going down the junior path, probably 14, 15.
Yeah.
People I talked to, they didn't give up on the other sports, but they spent a lot of time kind of developing, ramping up, getting ready. 16, 17 was when they were like fully committed. And that's kind of the pass.
Yeah.
What's your take on this new, I don't know if sanctioned or unsanctioned, HPL alliance that's come to Lower Mainland, where they're recruiting 6, 7, 8-year-old kids? Spring hockey.
We did a pretty good analysis of it and compared it to what we offer just in our sort of standard programming here for a novice player. And again, this is a rational take on it. So, you know, you're not going to convince irrational people, but we broke down really on a cost and that perspective for it. And what we found was, from what we offer in our program for kids of that age group, they're getting, and we've offered a little bit of an extra program for some of our more committed kids in that age group, but they're getting usually four ice times a week if you include their game time. Two of those would be with professional skills instructor, and the cost per ice time for those guys, we broke it down, it's probably $12 to $15. Per ice time that they're getting over the course of that week. And then we compared that with the HPL program, which I think is twice a week. And they're paying upwards of $60 per ice time and not getting any better program than we are. The only thing that they would have, I guess, that would be an attractive point would be the exclusivity of it, which we obviously don't offer that. Although we do a lot of our skill development in skill-based groupings, but you know, the one thing that I think people seem to be looking for is that exclusivity or that elite title. You know, I think I joke that nowadays, you know, it's tough to get in. Only 95% of the kids are elite, so it's a pretty pretty tight group to be in.
Yeah, there's that quote. Wayne Goldsmith is one of the guys that we interviewed for our summer summit, and I just love all the stuff he's doing in Australia. And he did this talk for Sport New Zealand about 3 years ago. It's about talent identification. His main role from about 1992 to 2000 was identifying potential high-performance athletes for the 2000 Brisbane Summer Games. Mm-hmm. So he went around all of Australia, and he said to all these parents in his presentation, there is no such thing as an elite 8-year-old.
Right.
Yeah. It's not part of my vocabulary. Please remove it from yours. And I just thought that quote, I got to share, for like, because I've been saying that forever, that elite acronym, for, as far as I'm concerned, is Olympic athletes, and everybody below that is either an early bloomer or just good, but they're not elite.
Yeah,
it's killing me that they're using that acronym at 6, 7, 8-year-old kids. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a great marketing term, I guess. It seems to be doing the trick for people, but it's crazy. I used to do a lot of hockey schools and things, and our bread and butter when we did that was your not necessarily recreational player, but I guess in today's world it would be your AA type player, and we had a very successful program for years doing that. And people say, well, you should do more of the elite programming. And at that time we're like, you know what, why would such a small market of so-called elite people, why would we go after that when there's such a healthy market of really good players? And now that's turned around. I think people have used that elite term and it encompasses everybody from a marketing perspective. And I don't know if there's cachet, like people go to a cocktail party and they say, my son is in an elite program. And someone says, hey, so's mine. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, but I think a lot of it is actually bragging rights for parents getting them into programs, because I first got wind of it from a coach in Cloverdale. He reached out to me and he goes, what's up with this? You know, we're putting our teams together, coaching novice 8-year-old kids. I'm concerned that if they do this and they're on my team, I'll never see them. They're not going to come to practices. And I'm like, I had no idea. So I did a little bit of digging. But right on their website, they're promoting that they're not just going to work with these kids, but they're going to get them ready the thing that threw me off the deep end for spring hockey.
Yeah.
I guess their whole plan and reason for being is not winter, but spring for the competition. And I remember talking to, I think you were actually at the summit last year when Corey McNabb, we're all in that room in Richmond, and he shared the anecdote about that super elite league in Ontario with the 6 and 7 year old kids, where they're playing 70 games a year.
Yeah.
Like, it's no wonder they're burning out. So they just, it's too much really, but it kind of precursors where I was going with their own specialization. But what led you down the path after you finished junior to go into coaching?
My nephews actually were, 5 years younger than me, and they were kind of getting started playing hockey and probably into their Adam years. And I was, just finishing up junior hockey, starting university kind of time. And I was like, yeah, I'll help out with your teams as a good uncle kind of should. Pass on what I'd learned from hockey and realized I was enjoying it. At the same time, I was also my summer job started to be working in hockey schools. So I was a hockey school instructor in the summer away from my studies, and obviously developed and worked with some great people there that passed on a lot of passion for the game, but probably more importantly, a passion for working with kids and working with youth, and really learned a lot from that, and thought I could continue on in that area and pass those skills on and combine that with the obvious passion I had for the game. So it kind of just grew from there, and opportunities just started to pop up, higher level teams, I guess, that type of thing started to come along the way, and I had actively searched to ways to get better as a coach, whether it was mentorship or conferences or courses, whatever, and grew as a coach in that area. Probably made a ton of mistakes and learned from that too. But
I think we all do, and that's the whole reason. My reason for being is helping those coaches that I work with in clinics that are just starting out, and I ask them, what are you hoping to get out of this? Well, a lot of them will say drills, practice planning, but then many will say, I'm trying to figure out how to connect with these 5, 6, 7, 8 year olds. Like, how do you connect with these kids? And there's tips and tricks that you only learn after you've done it for a while, and as you go up the pipeline. So, what was it like for you to be involved with the 2010 Winter Paralympics?
Oh, the highlight for sure of my professional career, anyways. So many great things there. Again, probably, some of it relates to my experiences of being on a team and working together and meeting challenges as a group. So obviously worked with a terrific group of people there. There was a lot of pressure to pull it off. A hockey event in Canada, the Olympics, it doesn't get much more pressure packed or under the microscope than that. And so I think that was awesome. We rose to the challenge and learned a ton from people there. It was just an awesome experience all around. And the volunteers that gave up their time just so impressed me, that the engagement that we had from those people, and also obviously our paid staff, but the volunteers, the passion they brought, and how everything kind of just pulled together. You can think of that, just that great hockey season or that great hockey game where everything, everything starts clicking and everyone's playing their role. And so it was awesome. And then of course it ended, and it's like, what do we, wow, that peaked and it was over. It was great.
Yeah. And were you at the final game and not making any assumptions?
Yeah, I was definitely at the final game. Luckily enough, I was,
games, cause there was both the women's and
definitely was at all of the big events, but in the men's gold medal game, I didn't really have a major role to play in that game, so I was actually sitting in the seats, and I had a couple of tickets, I guess, and what I did was rotated through some volunteers that otherwise wouldn't have seen the game because they were busy working and doing things, just to come up for half a period and just relax and enjoy the game and thank them for what they did. So it was sat there, and the tension ratcheted up in the in the game. And, you know, of course, the people around me in my section didn't understand the rules and, you know, what's going to happen now with overtime shootouts and all that. And I was a little more calm because I knew what was going on, I guess, to some degree. But anyways, it was pretty crazy. And as soon as the game ended, I was able to head down underneath and assume a role there of securing the site and making sure that, you know, we got all the equipment back and all that type of thing. And I think I was the first guy to high five Sidney Crosby when he left the ice surface.
Wow. Yeah, that was, you know, the goal, and then Iggy getting the assist for the goal. And the irony, Ryan Miller being in the net, who then ends up becoming the goalie for the Vancouver Canucks. So there were so many things that led up or from that game. So I ended up watching it on my home screen because we actually had a game that night. And I'll never forget when we were driving to the game. It was right after, and everybody was outside. They're clamoring their pots, their pans, a celebration. And this is, you know, the second one since we'd won in 2002. So it was a pretty amazing event. So, I mean, the whole model with, you know, goes back to Wayne Gretzky and all the sports he played and increasing his VO2 max because he's a cross country, but also baseball, lacrosse, a lot of stuff he could do. Sidney Crosby, a lot of stuff he does now because of the multiple sports. I mean, I could talk about 100 of them.
Yeah.
I can't talk about 100 single sport athletes because they usually burn out.
Yeah.
They get injured. Or they're not developing skills, they'll help them be that athlete instead of that hockey player.
Yeah, for
sure. That's what I keep telling everybody. It says, you know, like, I got to play at a high level, a lot of sports, and I won provincials in three different sports. That's kind of unheard of in today's
You
know, football, hockey, and rugby. Nobody does that anymore. Well, because I was an athlete, I wasn't in any particular sport. So,
Well, one of our success stories here, I mean, it wasn't a result of this direct partnership, but so we have Michael Rasmussen, who's playing for in his first year in with the Detroit Red Wings as a 19-year-old, and he I coached him when he was in Pee-wee hockey with us, and at the same time he was playing relatively high level rep soccer with Coastal, or the precursor to Coastal FC. And I remember we made a conscious effort when I was coaching him, saying try to do as much of the soccer as you can. And there was pushback from, you know, he's our best player and he's missing because he's going to a soccer tournament or has a soccer thing or whatever. You know, we're going to lose these games or whatever. It's like, you know, come on.
Yeah.
Exactly. The athlete development that we want to have. And he was able to juggle both sports at the time quite successfully. I think he also played, you know, school basketball, and of course he was top at all those sports because he was such a good athlete, but all those sports helped contribute to his athleticism, and I would suspect probably made him a better hockey player at the end of the day once he did decide to specialize in that area. And there's hundreds of those stories, but you know, we're trying to maybe schedule kids out of that or pressure kids out of that when we should be going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I agree. I think you had touched on it earlier where, you know, the organizations, they identify a strong athlete, strong player, and they compete for that person. Like, and that's what the scheduling has not permitted. I had a kid on my Bantamon A1 team, and he was at the top level, and I kind of lost track of the levels of soccer because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
Like, and they it's not like A1, A2.
Right.
It's just like but he was playing top soccer and Bantam A1 hockey, and everybody was worried, is this kid going to be able to pull it off? I don't know how he pulled it off, but he also learned how to fly a plane that year.
Wow.
As his defeat. Like, this kid was, like, doing all this stuff. I'm like, he can do it. And he was an amazing, gifted athlete. Yeah. That's what I kept telling everybody. I said, you know, if you're just going to play one, you're not going to become an athlete. You're going to become a hockey player. And the world, as they get older, and a lot of people like the Steven Norris is in the sport for life, all these people I connect with all the time, we call those kids motor morons because they're really adept at that sport, but they're not able to cross over the skills that'll help them even further. Like, thinking in hockey, if you're receiving a pass on your skate and you're going to kick it to your stick, are you going to learn that necessarily in hockey? No. If you do all the repetition in soccer, you become a lot more adept at it.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of other sports. So,
well, we see it. I mean, I look at players playing in the Bantam and Midget, even at the A1 level, and I watch them on the ice in certain things, and I can tell in a lot of cases that they're hockey. And one of the ones is their ability to process things from a 360 degree perspective, because nowadays a lot of the hockey training is straight ahead, going through cones and obstacles and looking in one direction. And you just repeat that over and over again. Where that kid that's playing volleyball, for example, he's turning around, he's looking at what's going on behind him, he's receiving the ball from multiple different places and different angles. And same thing even with the basketball player and athlete. And that, just by osmosis, kind of should translate into someone's hockey game. If they're not getting that experience, I see those guys that just they're go, and really in one direction, and they don't have that. That's just one example. Never mind, you know, the things like the footwork skills or batting a puck out of the air or whatever, but it's more that spatial awareness from a number of different avenues that they just pick up by doing those other activities.
Yeah, it's the actual game IQ, which is 98% of the game you're playing without the puck on your stick. Right. And positional play, like, is a big pet peeve of almost every coach I talk to. Watching these kids now, like, they're not really playing the game like they could. And lack of creativity is a big, big one. Like, it wasn't so structured in practices, you know, tactics, and not skill development, giving the opportunity for stick and puck or what have you. So they develop their creativity. And I think that whole, of course, the for the love of the game, that passion, so that they keep going.
Yeah, I mean, that again, that's the number one, our message to our coaches. And I just had a coach one entry level coaching clinic on the weekend as well with our group. And I said, you know, skill development's great, but the number one thing we have to teach and instill our kids is to love the game. And I said to them, I see a ton of 14, 15 year old players with immense skill that quit. So why, you know, if you spend all your time on the skill development, you're going to have these really skilled kids that don't carry on playing. I'd much rather have that, even to trying to develop a top level player, that love of the game where they just keep staying in the game and keep getting better and better. As I said to them, when they get to that older age group, the 14, 15 year old age group, and they want to carry on as hockey players, they're going to face all kinds of adversity. They're going to get cut from teams. They're going to get injured. They're going to have things not go their way. They're going to have a coach they don't like. They're going to all these things. They're going to have, teammates that don't work out for them or whatever. All kinds of things are going to come at them. And what keeps them going? Not that they're more skilled or better skilled than these guys. It's that they just love it. So they persevere through that stuff. They find ways around it. They stay in the, you know, they stay in the battle, and they keep working on their skills and getting better at it. But, if we spend all our time on just building skills without building fun and building a love of the game in there, we're not going to ultimately develop players that either play for a lifetime or that even get to those top levels, because the first sign of trouble, they'll be out of there.
Yeah, they're not handling adversity because of those challenges they will face later on. You're not always going to have a great coach. You're not always going to have a great environment. You may have teammates on your team that are not the greatest to play with, but if you love that, you'll just push your way through, like you said.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting statistic I got from, I talked to Rick Benson, this is the executive director for Softball BC, and they, like every sport, suffering attrition. They're losing girls. It's like a lot of sports are losing boys. He said, if we can get them to 14 and basically get that through that 2-3 year challenge years, which is the 11, 12, 13, where things can either go one way or the other. Once they get to 14, he says the retention is really, really high. One, because the girls will just keep going on to midget. Many of them will go play either fast pitch or slow pitch. But it's that 3-year kind of bubble years, you know, the PWA and going into bantam. That's when they're going to decide whether to keep going. And for me, the bantam 1 years was probably the deal breaker for most kids. They're going to go, yeah, or they're going to go, no.
Yeah.
So that they're going to go yes if they love it. They're going to go no if they don't. And that's where the smiles disappear from a lot of these kids' faces.
For sure. Yeah, and the irony is for most of them, it is kind of that year and the next year beyond where they really can start to develop. like, you know, this race to I mean, the Bantam draft doesn't help, obviously, in hockey, but this, you know, this race to get there at 13 and 14 is a shame. And you know, you've either climbed the mountain at that point and maybe you carry on, or you didn't, so you drop off. It's such a shame, because the number of athletes that we've seen, and we're starting to see that, you know, they're plodding their way along maybe to that Bantam level, but then they get to that age group. Now they're 14, 15. When they go to the gym, they actually, hey, I'm starting to get starting to work. I'm getting some muscles here. With that comes some confidence. Wow. If I work at this, I'll see results. And that translates a bit into their on ice experience as well. And you're starting to see some of, you know, that's an age where kids can really catch fire and develop. Unfortunately, the system conspires against them, that they're, you know, in some ways washed up has-beens at that point, because they haven't been identified or on a particular track at that point. And it's a shame. And there's a number of stories of guys that have obviously, that's been their success, and they've done that, but there should be more of that. There should be more avenues for those kind of players to thrive, and we should be seeking them out. I mean, it's easy for you know, a scout or a talent identifier to, you know, to pick out that guy that's put in the 10,000 hours by the time he's 13 and say, you know, that guy's really good because he's put all this time in. The challenge is finding that guy who's, man, he's just a little bit under where that guy's at, but he's only getting started. What's the ceiling on that kid, and how do we feed that? How do we develop that kid? Because especially if they bring a passion at that age, look out, this guy's the limit for those kids, and they'll blow by that other guy. But we don't have a method for identifying those guys very well, or for supporting them.
Yeah, it's basically the whole tortoise and hare analogy, right?
Yeah.
The tortoise slowly plods his way, late bloomer, and then all of a sudden, 16, 17 years old. And a lot of the university coaches see that, because they're getting them at 18. And they're still developing, they're still spending time on skill, but also, hey, and we'll introduce all the other stuff. Jamie Benn is one of those perfect examples.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, baseball. I played winter hockey just to stay in shape. And then all of a sudden he gets a junior B age group and gets, hey, come play junior B. And then, oh, come play junior A. And then he was 19 when he was on Hockey Canada's radar.
Like, yeah.
Because he wasn't really a hockey guy. Sure. And then all of a sudden, hey, you won a gold medal. Hey, I've got the bug for hockey. Look at him now. He's captain. Yeah. He's got a multi-year contract. He's Art Ross Trophy. All that other great stuff, because he's a great athlete, right? So many testimonials they can say. But the late bloomer analogy, for me, is kind of frustrating, because kids, they may not even gain that weight until they go through that last growth spurt.
Yeah.
Late teens. My son never went through it. I thought, okay, he's got my genetics. No, he's still 5'7", you know, 160 pounds. So he's not playing junior, but he's playing adult league and he's loving it. So it's one of those things. So,
yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, and I think, you know, nowadays there's also that self-esteem and recognition piece that's getting a little out of whack too, because you're seeing these rankings come out of the top, 10-year-olds or top 11-year-olds and that type of thing, which I would think plays with parents' psyches, but plays with kids' psyches as well, that, man, if you're not in this ranking thing at 10 or 11, why carry on? Or I'm not as good as this guy. Or, and also from a scouting perspective, you got to think that there's some, maybe some laziness involved in those guys that are supposed to be the professional talent identifiers that are just following these lists and these rankings that really don't have a lot behind them and really don't mean anything. But there's a danger that that's scaring kids off from continuing to persevere or develop over a longer term horizon. Because, man, I wasn't on that brick team at 9 or that 10-year-old all-star team. What's the point, right? So
yeah, and I think that's partly the more those numbers get out there, social media access, that's what's driving the parental craziness in a sense, because they want their kids to be at that level sooner than later. So there are on radar screens, and I've talked to probably 5 or 6 different local associations, and they've shared with me that they got parents that are appealing rep releases from Atom A1 to Atom A2, so AAA to AA, because they're concerned the kids are not going to get scouted.
Right.
And I'm just like, Yeah, I know we're in Western Canada. We're due the draft a year earlier than we should because they have minor, major, midget in Eastern Canada because of numbers. We don't. Yeah. When I talked to a lot of scouts, the reason why we do it a year earlier is because it takes them that much time to get to all these different rinks and see all these kids. But, sure. You know, if they're going to be on a radar screen, regardless of where they're playing, they're going to be found.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You don't have to go into these crazy expensive academies. I heard an analogy from one of the scouts I was talking to on the weekend. They ran into a dad and he almost bragged about it. He says, yeah, I put all three of my kids through an academy and it averaged like 30 grand a year because he had everything. He was billeting the whole nine yards. So 90 grand per kid. And he had ended up with a first mortgage, a second mortgage interest only, a third mortgage interest only, almost $300,000 in debt. And he joked about it. He says, you know, if I sell my house today, I'll probably be able to break even, or I'm still going to owe the bank about 10 grand because he's going to lose all the equity. And I was just like, what? Like, and none of these kids got drafted.
No. Yeah. No, it's, there's a few stories of that. I know we joke that, a 1 or 2% interest rate hike is going to kill the hockey industry in BC because people are using that equity and mortgages and things from their houses to fuel it.
Yeah, I think we've all been there. I mean, I tried to do best I could support my kids and everything, and I look back and how much I paid them. Like, whoa, and what did we get out of it? What was the return on investment?
Yeah.
Did they enjoy the experience for the most part? But they got in those crazy competitive years. It was almost too much over the top, and yeah.
The ones that worry me there are those ones that somehow get convinced by others that if they don't do this, they're going to fall behind, and there's that pressure to do something that they're probably not comfortable with from a financial standpoint, but maybe even from this doesn't make a lot of sense, but. I have to do it. I have to go to this program because otherwise I'll fall behind. Or this kid did it and it worked for him. And, you know, trying to tell people, everybody's got a different path of development that they can go there. You got to do what's going to work for your player or your athlete. Don't follow the herd, without at least being informed on it. So, you know, that's part of our job. And I think you guys are doing a really good job of that, of educating parents that there are a lot of different ways to get there. And there's a ton of research out there that people just ignore on being a multi-sport athlete, on not early sports specialization, the long-term athlete development model. We've had millions and millions of dollars of our tax dollars have been spent on that. But meanwhile, some guy with a glossy brochure that says elite on it is telling you something different. And you believe that's what is so frustrating, that, just do your homework and find out what the experts and the academics are telling us.
And the irony is I was at, UBC's kinesiology, book launch for Minds in Motion. It was great. I actually got an award and it was really, really kind of surreal. But at that event, they shared one of the people that went up was a professor and he had hence retired, but he was part of that initial kind of growth of the UBC kinesiology program in the 80s and 90s. And said they started seeing overuse injuries in the 80s, like in the 80s. And I'm like, whoa. So it's been, and it, because of the specialization, but where it really ramped up, it's probably the last 10 or 15 years. That's when I said, you know, we got to change this because these kids, they're going to quit, get injured. And it was an interesting study that one of the speakers on the summit shared with Duff Gibson. He goes, yeah, I came across this study and somebody sent it to me. It was done in Germany and they surveyed 1,600 of their high performance athletes and went down the early specialization path. Many showed early results that, yeah, it was kind of helping them because they were early bloomers versus the late bloomers. But majority of those athletes burned out, got injured, and most of them became sedentary in their adult years because they didn't have that passion, that love of the game that you're promoting, and they just didn't want to do it anymore. So, yeah, you might see the early success, but you're not going to see the long-term success, and it's been shown over and over and over again.
Yeah. Well, even more dangerous, that, like you say, that a kid that quits at Bantam A1, who was, you know, they put a lot of time and effort into their fitness and their development and all those sort of things, but they quit in frustration or whatever at that particular stage. Generally, the studies have shown those kids don't pick up another sport. They don't pick up another activity. They don't continue playing even hockey into adulthood recreationally. And they get fat and lazy and have health issues.
And they're getting type 2 diabetes before they become an adult, which is a real scary statistic. Right. So we kind of talked about the two big is our, and that third issue that a lot of parents are saying is affecting, especially hockey, is the cost, the financial outlay. Academies are like starting to explode. How do we combat that? How do we get parents to understand you have a cost-effective model? Your son or daughter can play pretty high-level hockey at the minor. I'm sure your numbers, you're losing to academies, you're losing to minor, major, midget. What's your take on that, and how do you get parents to understand the pros and cons of both?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's we joke sometimes that if we offer the same program for three times the price, our popularity will go way up.
Or $5,000, you choose.
Yeah, exactly. So we seem to be losing the common sense argument of, you know, normally you would think it would just be value for money. Am I getting a valuable service for what I'm paying? And a reasonable person would say, you know what, I don't mind paying, $5,000 if I'm getting really good value for that particular amount of money I'm paying, and I'm receiving this amount of ice time, this amount of coaching, et cetera, et cetera. It's certainly a tough argument sometimes to put that in there. I think the part of it is, what are the measuring sticks? How are things getting measured? Is it, you know, you're seeing a lot of, well, if I don't go to that team, I don't get drafted, or that team's winning, so I'm going to go there, therefore it's a good program. I think we need to make sure that we're educating people on what their end goals are for their child or their player. And if it's about getting drafted or getting exposure or whatever, and you're not afraid to spend the money to do that, okay, well, go ahead and do it. But if it's about developing your child to his full potential as an athlete and more, then you could probably be way more judicious with how you spend your money, and everyone would benefit. So I think there's that piece. The other piece now that is a bit where we call them the profiteers. Traditionally, you know, minor sport had been run as a not-for-profit type of venture, and there was a lot of strain on volunteers, and it is tougher and tougher to get volunteers to step up and give their time. So I get that piece that there may be some increased cost pressure now because there is a little bit more professionalization of coaching and instruction and those sort of things just inevitably. But what we're seeing now is just this profit piece, and I see it as money leaving the system essentially, that is just going into people's pockets and not really being reinvested back into the kids or into the growth of the structure of the system. And, you know, that's worrisome, that there's really, in my opinion, millions of dollars in the Lower Mainland that are really kind of not being circulated effectively in the sport system, whereas if there was more of a not-for-profit type of model, even with professional coaching and those sort of things, that money and those resources would circulate in the system for the betterment of the system and for the betterment of the players. And, you know, that's one of the concerns, that somewhere we've got to get a handle on that piece, and even parents have to realize, you know, where's my money going? I think there's money wasted on bus rides and travel. Like you know that message, you really don't get better sitting on the bus for 6 hours to go to, you know, Penticton or Kelowna to play two games in a weekend. Like, you spend that same money on development and extra ice time and those sort of things, if you need to, you're going to get better quicker. So that whole competitive model that we have to, you know, we have to play these teams that are far flung because that's where the concentration of talent might be. I think that's, that's driving the cost up, I think, unnecessarily.
Yeah, the travel thing is put me off the deep end. Is the coaches want to go farther and farther and farther away.
Right.
Now it's planes, trains, automobiles, longer tournaments, hotel stays, food, meals. The average is about $3,000 a tournament.
Yeah.
For a kid to maybe, if you get to the fifth game, you get maybe you get 100 minutes of ice time. Well, that's just over a practice.
Yeah.
And the stats are one good practice equates to 11 games played, amount of puck time they have and all that other stuff. I just don't get it. So if you're going to take that money, buy 5 sheets of ice.
Yeah.
You could almost, with the amount of money you go to some of these travel tournaments, you almost bring in Guy Lafleur or Marilyn Lemieux or Mike Bossy or some icon, like Bobby Orr. You could spend $10,000, bring in Bobby Orr, run your ice off.
Yeah.
And you've saved your team like $40,000. And people just look at me and go, what? I said, that's where it is. The development is on the practice, not in the game.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, your 100 minutes is assuming they're distributed equally. Imagine you're that guy that's paying the freight really for everybody else, and you're getting a small percentage of that time, and your development's really suffering. So,
yeah.
So that's one of the, you know what, I mean, one of the concerns. You're familiar with the landscape on the Lower Mainland a little bit, and, you know, there was one of the pushes, I think, a little bit for these academies or the ability for them to rise was there was a perceived concern that, you know, the regular minor hockey in the Phantom League was watered down, for example. You know, we had 10 or 12 teams in the Flight 1 division, and we needed to have, you know, I want to play with the better players or concentration of talent or whatever. So these elite groups started to pop up. Well, we're going to head into next year. We're probably going to have 5 zone Bantam teams in the Lower Mainland and 6 or 7 academy teams in the Lower Mainland with the talent dispersed across all those particular teams. So we're right back where we were 5 years ago.
The only full circle.
3 or 4 times the cost.
Yep.
So it's it really... We let it get out of hand in that regard, for sure.
Yeah, I think it was, again, coming back to bragging rights, my kid's playing for this academy or he's playing for this AAA. And where I really started shifting the model with spring hockey, I remember like hockey 3 and hockey 4, watching all these parents in the corners, and I found out what they were talking about, where their kid's going to go try out and what team he's been invited to. And they're starting to recruit kids in September.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah, for
at least
sure.
When I was coaching, they were recruiting them in February. But now it's September. Like, well, then you got to come to our weekend and do this. And it's kind of like that other model. I'm like, when's going to end? And it's hockey, hockey, hockey. Like the infamous Get More from Sport video they put out last year from Sport Nova Scotia was great.
Yeah, brilliant.
And the guy is saying, you know, my son could have played blah, blah, high level. And they ask him, well, what's he doing now? He's not an astronaut. And all these funny anecdotes in that. It was brilliant because what percentage actually get to even junior?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
And from junior, how many 0.03% have a shot at the NHL? And that's even if you sign a contract, like Jamie Benn, that's why he's such a success story. He was drafted in the 5th round.
Right. Yeah.
How many of those guys even get a whiff at the NHL? So, anyway, we're kind of getting close to that hard stop. So, I got one last question in terms of the rapid fire. I get asked all the time, my coaches in every clinic, everywhere I go, doesn't matter where I am across the country, how to deal with parents. And I counter back and say, it's not about dealing with parents, it's about engaging them. What's your tip for those coaches to engage parents on their teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think the communication piece is so important. Most of the situations we deal with from parents is when the parents make up a story in their own head of what is going on with their child. They perceive that their child is being treated unfairly or whatever it might be. And usually it comes from if there was a little bit more clear communication from the coach to the parents. As far as what the expectations are, and even taking it a step further and involving the parent group in helping kind of guide those expectations for the kids, and then clear and concise rapport with the parents right up front to say, hey, listen, I'm seeing, you know, for example, your child's not meeting this particular expectation either in his play or his behavior and attitude. Having those conversations, as difficult as they might be, early in the process, so that the parents are in the loop and can work with you on stuff, I think saves you a ton of headaches. And it also, if you're able to empower the parent group to be a team amongst themselves, so they're policing themselves, I guess, to some degree, or holding themselves accountable for their behavior at games and events, and they're on board the same way maybe that the players are. Difficult to do, but I think that's the challenge that coaches definitely are. I mean, you can't, if you're going to ignore that parent group rather than engage them, like you say, you'll be dealing with issues. So yeah. Right from the get-go, if they're engaged, they're part of things, they're updated in all the things that you're doing, a part of your seasonal plan, you're sharing your seasonal plan with them, you're going to be way better off. And they may have different goals than you do as a coach. As long as you're clear, say, hey, listen, you guys might not agree with everything I'm doing, but here's what my plan is. And I think they would get some respect from the parents that they put the time and effort to build a plan and are trying to stick to it.
Yeah, and the younger and earlier age groups won't be as detailed, but especially when you get to the rep stream, parents' expectations are higher. They're paying a lot more money. They definitely want somebody that's in that driver's seat that, right, A, is going to help develop the kids from a skill perspective, their life skills, help them become better people, and communicate with them so that they're informed, not chasing. And the frustration point, I've heard stories from parents, I can't even use the language, where a coach will walk into the meeting, I don't deal with parents, and like, he'll walk out. And I've had so many parents say that to me. I'm like, what? What? Like he's coaching minor hockey, or he's coaching baseball, or what? How can you do that? And that's what's leading, I think, a lot of that's what's escalating the behavior in the stands.
Yeah.
And self-policing is also a recommendation. But the other one that I say to all coaches is, have you ever done goal setting with your players? And some do. And I said, well, have you ever done goal setting with the parents?
Right.
You know, no. I said, well, tell you what, do this. Ask your parents or ask your players, you know, what do they want to achieve that season? One personal goal. And what should our team goal be for the season? So that's your kids. Do the same thing with the parents. What's your goal for your son or daughter this season? What's the team goal? And I guarantee the parent goals are going to be results driven. Right. And the player goals usually are going to be social driven. I want to be with my buddies. I want to have fun and all that stuff. But if they're not aligning, then that parental expectation is what's causing that ride home issue. It's causing the screaming in the stands, the criticism of kids, and they're just going to quit. You bring them into perspective and alignment, you got a great season, and parents love it. You love it. They have fun. And it to me, it's not rocket science, but for some reason or another, it just puts a lot of coaches in that kind of that uncomfortable space that, oh, I'm now engaging parents. Yeah. But if you don't do it, you're going to be in trouble. It's a lot, hockey especially. It's like, what, an 8-month season? That's a long season to be dealing with any kind of issues.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky now. The workload on a coach today is much more than it probably was 10 or 12 years ago, even.
Yep.
But I guess they go in eyes open. It's part of the package.
Yeah, and if you go in it for one reason, and the big reason is for the kids, and hopefully it'll all the other stuff we have to do. And there's a lot more certification that's happening, even USA Hockey. So last few questions, rapid fire. What can we do to ensure that kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning?
Make it fun, number one. Make sure that there's a social environment for them that is safe, enjoyable. I think, you know, just leadership from a coach is important, that the kids are following a plan from A to B over the course of the season. I think that's part of it. Again, that they develop their skills. There's nothing that that makes a kid feel better than their growth, that they've learned a certain skill they maybe didn't have before, or improved a certain skill or area. So those pieces are there. I think taking stock of things throughout the season so they can measure their success, so that they actually, sometimes you can have some successes and not even realize it because you maybe get caught up in the negatives, but taking time throughout the season to take stock of the successes that you've had individually or as a team. I think that helps kids feel better at the end of the year.
Yeah, great answer. Okay, favorite book to recommend to coaches, what would it be?
Wow. I mean, for me, it's probably non-hockey leadership books.
Doesn't have to be.
So I mean, I don't have a title, but there's some good ones out there on leadership and communication, I think, in the business world that that apply really well to working with hockey players.
Okay, any resources or books that you'd recommend to parents because of some of the craziness we see in the stands?
Well, your website and your information is valuable. Let's start with that.
Thank you.
I mean, there's, I'm trying to think of the titles. There's a couple of, I mean, the Allison Tufts book is a good one. Behind the Glass, I think it's called.
Yeah, Lessons Behind the Glass. She's on our summer summit, and it's crazy. She had, her reach was amazing, and all these people said, oh, we loved her talk, and so we're replaying it in our winter summit.
Yeah. So I've met her on a couple of occasions too, and her perspective is really good, but she's able to articulate that really well in within her book. So that's one I recommend and hand out often to parents. Actually, I have it handy right beside my desk. So when parents come in, I can point them to that one. Actually, while we're at it, I got this one's a good one too.
Yeah, just bring it up a bit.
Say that word?
No, just bring it up so that it can actually.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, there we go. Okay.
Yeah, the no asshole rule. It's called. So it's trying to build your team or your workplace, you always have those people that take away energy, and it's how you either work those people on board or work them out of where you're at. So those kind of things.
Great. Okay, last question. What's the number one tip you would share for a new coach, one that's just starting out, to help them shave 5 years off their learning curve?
I think do it for the right reasons, probably the first one. Like if you're coming into it, it's for the right reasons, and tell them right off the bat that you're not coaching hockey, you're coaching kids. So if they can get that difference, that definitely helps them out. And then the other probably tip would be just over communicate. I think most of the issues that people have in coaching is they just don't communicate either with their players, their assistant coaches, or with their parents.
Yeah, great tips. Great talk. Great. I love you taking the time for this, and hopefully coaches got some great nuggets. Thanks for making the time. It was fantastic. It was great.
No problem. My pleasure. Best of luck.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter, and for loveofthegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.